For those of you that are not familiar with the way we do this live stream, generally we'll start with some beer news and some genus news, and then we transition on to our beer of the week, which is where we choose a more or less random beer style from the usually from the beer judging certification program BJCP, and give a breakdown on that, and then we pick a hop, yeast, and malts that we would like to use if we were to brew that style ourselves. A lot of times we already have brewed the style. This week doesn't seem to be the case for that. And then at the end we go on to discussion topics and we finish off with some overall open discussion. Peter's just about ready, so let's just start in with genus news this week. And the most obvious news as of a couple days ago is that we are now, at least, what is it, Spokane County is now in phase 2 in reference to the COVID-19 outbreak, which means that restrictions have been lifted and we are actually allowed to be more or less fully functional and serve beer in our tap room, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, so phase 2 is specific to Washington State. It is a governor plan thing that says, you know, as we get less and less COVID new cases, we can slowly start to peel back the curtains a little bit. Phase 2 for us means that we still have to make sure that people are social distance while in the tap room, but we do have limited capacity. We've got to have things like masks available for people, hand sanitizer available for people, doing everything we can. But you know, the bottom line there is we can't have people in the tap room drinking beer, and we can give samples out again, which is one of the biggest things for people that are trying to get, like, to-go packages and stuff.
Yeah. Man, we got people tuning in from everywhere this morning.
Croatia,
too.
Sweden.
Yeah.
Nice. Mexico, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Nebraska, that's like a different country almost. Go Huskers.
Hey, Tom finally caught a live stream, so that's cool, too.
Yeah.
So we are open. We've been serving beer for 1.5 days again, and
solid.
Luckily haven't been overwhelmed with people because our capacity in the tap room was pretty low to start with. So technically we can only have like 23 people, 22 and a half people in our tap room.
We can round up. We'll round up to 25. No one's going to know. 25 people. And I don't think that we're going to be super, we're not going to be having to kick people away, because there's a lot of people in Spokane still, you know, doing what they need to be doing and staying at home if they're, you know, if they feel any insecurities there. And then when they come in, they've been really good about, you know, respecting that social distancing and stuff like that. So I don't think we're going to have to be mean about turning people away. We're not going to get like this place packed. It's not going to be a party in here, but it is nice to be able to have people drinking.
Yes, certainly so. I think everybody likes the slightly more return to normalty. So, anyway, on to other news for this week. Tim actually brewed up a big Belgian double-ish IPA. So that has been tearing apart one of our little one-barrel fermenters. And so I'm kind of excited for that. That should be out and on tap here in another few weeks. Did you see when that was fermenting?
Yeah.
The thing was just, it just ripped through some beer wort. And then, also on the downside of things, we did have a somewhat, I would call it a failed sour experiment. I don't know if we discussed this in one of our previous live streams, but, we planned on making a YouTube video on how to do basically a sour in three different ways.
But we had some miscommunication when it came to, who all was supposed to be doing what. And so some people missed the mark on what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, things didn't get done, and then we kind of neglected the fermenters for a minute.
Yeah,
and
it was we had a lot going on in the last few weeks, and so it was a little bit of a debauchery. But I mean, the beer is not beer that we're going to be putting on tap. I wouldn't say it's like terrible beer, but it's definitely just not up to our standards, and so we are going to have to redo that.
So, but yeah, we're going to try again. So for those of you that were hoping to see that video sooner than later, unfortunately, I got bad news for you. It's going to be delayed a little bit.
But, more bad news, because this is a fun and exciting, happy time style news show, is that supply chains are melting down across the country. Oh, no.
That's true. Yeah, we are actually. So we've heard word for the last probably month, 6 weeks now about people not being able to get brewing ingredients all around the world, actually, and how the supply chain issues have been had a major impact on them. And up until just really this week, we haven't felt that until we did a regular order through one of our wholesalers. And quite literally half of the items we ordered were out of stock. And then fortunately that means that we were outed on a lot of things that we really need. You know, wheat DME was one of those. And also, besides just, things like malts, yeast actually has been, out of stock for a few weeks now, from one of our regular suppliers, and that's Imperial yeast.
Probably because they're also out of DME, so they can't.
Yeah, and I think that comes down to the fact that they actually use an organic malt extract, so that everything they do is organic. And I think they've been really having a hard time getting a hold of that. So yeah, as a result, they've actually been out of the probably half, if not more, of their yeast strains for the last few weeks. And luckily, we had some back stock, but we have more or less burned through that now, and so we are hurting on some liquid yeast cultures at the moment.
So if you're in Spokane and you're looking to get yeast from us, we're sorry if we don't have it, especially if it's an Imperial strain, but I promise it's not our fault. We're trying our best to get those back. We definitely want to have all this yeast in stock because we like playing, and now we can't play as much. Dang it.
Why yeast so far has not had that issue?
But we've been at it on German ale so far for white yeast. Yeah. So one yeast from them.
So we do still have some white yeast in stock, so... keep that in mind. You might just have to make some substitutes.
Even more cool, the next genus news is that we got a sweet new camera.
Right here.
Bum, bum.
Oh, hey, yeah, there it is.
This little guy. So I actually got to use this for Will It Beer. That would be, is it six or six?
Six,
okay.
Yes.
Will It Beer six. So we have two Will It Beers that are already filmed, by the way, and one Will It Beer that is about to be filmed tomorrow. So we've got a lot of those coming out. So those of you who enjoy the Will It Beer challenges, the chopped style brewing challenges, each consecutive video is getting better and better. We're trying to up our production quality and up the seamlessness of transitions going from like getting the ingredients to brewing the beers. So a lot's happening there. But I got a fun new camera that I got to use for Will It Beer 6 when I went shopping for the secret ingredients.
Speaking of which, we also shop Will It Beer 6. Totally. Just glanced over that.
Oh,
one.
Yeah. That by the way, that happened.
So we had two more local breweries come on Wednesday. Yep, that was a day.
Wednesday is the day of the week.
And
fun fact for those who don't know.
So Four-Eyed Guys Brewing and For the Love of God Brewing came. And so they have beer both fermenting right now in a couple of our Amazon fermenters, actually, that we do have a video coming out about that I had to get down and dirty with. But. Hey, they work.
Hey, they're functional. And I'm actually really excited for that Will It Beer Challenge, too, because those are two brewers that both try to push the boundaries in terms of, like, what is normal. So, you know, we're taking a step away from people that, you know, that do a lot of your average, you know, your Amber's IPAs, you know, even just your English-style beers. These two people both do pretty far. Yeah, right in there. Yeah, I see what you're doing. I was like, what the hell is going on? Pretty far out there beers, and so I'm really excited to see what they do with the challenge. Obviously, we've already seen what they started to do, but I'm more excited to have that in my mouth.
Yep. So really fun stuff. Also, I guess I ordered just this morning. I ordered a new video card for my computer at home so I can actually edit our videos again. So that's also cool. Hey, random thought. If you guys are all watching out there and you actually are thinking about starting a beer brewing YouTube channel yourselves, throw a comment down below, maybe and just ask us if you want us to do like a video on sort of a walkthrough, because we've been doing this for a few years now, and I think we've sort of learned a lot along the ways. So if you want us to do a whole video on like everything from, you know, the do's and don'ts to
the camera equipment that we use,
the editing equipment and software,
like what all we make videos with. If that's interesting to you at all, I know I've had CH from Homebrew for Life reach out to me and say he'd be interested in looking at that. And so I kind of want to get a little temperature gauge to see how many of you guys would be interested in seeing what we make videos with as well.
So, yeah. Otherwise, I think that pretty much sums up the genus news.
Which brings us on to the...
We're not doing beer news? Oh, we don't have any beer news. Beer news, nothing else happened.
Yeah, there's a blank line.
There's just a blank line for beer news. Actually, beer news, really, there hasn't been much going on. Everybody's just sort of stagnating in the same situation they've been in because rest of the world is not in the same situation that we are.
Three Floyds tap room definitely didn't shut down permanently or anything like that.
Oh. I don't even know that.
But, I mean, yeah, so nothing's happened. Nothing's happened. And now for the most anticipated jingle in all of internet history, the... Beer of the week. Bump, bump, bump. Beer of the week. Bump, woo.
Nailed it.
You're welcome.
All right. And that is BJCP Category 12B Australian sparkling ale. Did I say that perfectly?
No, you didn't say it with the accent.
Oh.
Australian sparkling
accent.
How many Australians are watching us right now going,
what? People are
going
to be like, that's a Kiwi accent, you dick.
I think they're going to say, like, that's like a, you know, some demon from the underworld accent. What are you doing?
Oh, yeah, I'm rocking the corn dew still. I was going to cut this off for everyone today, but I was going to have Peter cut it off. But
yeah, you get a
logistics
little,
and stuff.
A little shearing going on
anyway,
live stream.
Back to Australian sparkling ale. So did you research this, Peter, by the way?
No, I did absolutely zero research.
Perfect.
For this.
Good thing I actually read through it. It's a really, really interesting style. And this is essentially a session pale ale done Australian style in the best way I can interpret it. These beers are designed to be drank during the summer months, during warm weather. And the biggest characteristics is that they are, one, nice and highly carbonated, two, nice and dry, and then actually push through the yeast more than anything else, which is surprising. Also, another fun fact I found out about this style is that it actually, even though the style says sparkling, which would indicate that the beer would be crystal clear, some versions are not clear at all, and some versions are actually marketed to be a sort of flip keg style in order to get yeast back in suspension.
Mac and Jacks.
So, yeah, exactly. Something like a Mac and Jack. Something like, does Widmer Hefeweizen still do that?
I hope not. I don't know for sure. I know there's a handful of flip kegs that I get in, and every time that somebody delivers me a flip keg, I say, don't do it.
Yeah.
Don't put that upright.
It's kind of dumb, honestly. Yeah, so the bottom line, though, is that the yeast is important. So let's actually give you a quick
history. Brewing records show that the majority of Australian beer brewed in the 19th century draft XXX mild and porter ale in bottles was originally developed to compete with imported bottle pale ales from British breweries such as Bass and W.M. Younger Monk. By the 20th century, bottled pale ale went out of fashion and lighter lager beers were in vogue. Like, vogue, that's like, you know, when you pose a lot and like look pretty. Many Australian sparkling and pale ales were labeled as ales, but were actually bottom fermented lagers with very similar grists to ales as they replaced Coopers, Adelaide, South Australia. Oh, South Australia is the only surviving brewer producing the sparkling ale, except for you guys at home, because now you know.
So, yeah, so let's get right on to the yeast that we chose, or I chose, I guess. And I think, so typically you're going to use some kind of a British ale-based yeast, and part of the things that you're trying to get from that, that the style suggests, is you're trying to get notes of peach floral notes and, like, apricot notes. So basically floral and kind of stone fruitiness. Some of those are obviously going to come from the hops you use. But according to what I've read, most of that is actually going to be from the yeast strain itself. On top of a sulfury nose,
nice.
Which you don't get from British ale yeast. Yeah. And that's why I'm kind of switching things up. So I actually chose two yeast for our yeast for this style. And the first one is going to be a traditional British yeast. It's going to be Y-Yeast 1335, and that's their British Ale 2. I know that's a really good, solid performer, pretty clean at low temps, but I would actually recommend fermenting this right around 70 degrees to sort of push the upper end of that yeast strain.
Yeah, and if you get a little free rise in the middle and it pops up to like 71, 72, ain't nothing
yeah,
wrong
exactly.
with that.
Exactly. But then actually I would also recommend either Y yeast or Imperial, probably Y yeast right now, but some kind of a Czech lager yeast strain to co-pitch with that British ale while still fermenting that hot. And just because I know those strains are notorious for throwing sulfur.
Yeah.
And typically the sulfur is going to be in the water, but I know, you know, most people at home probably don't have some kind of a water chem to add additional sulfur to your water. So I feel like actually co-pitching, fermenting hot, you're actually going to get a little more fruitiness from that Czech lager strain. You're going to get some sulfur thrown off from it. And I feel like those two will actually complement each other really well.
I like it.
Bam. So anyway, so let's go on to the hops. So the hops are really interesting in this style. It actually states that the hops are often going to be of also British descent / origin, but generally, they're going to be an Australian hops, hence be why the name is what it is. So we chose Waiiti, Waiiti is a daughter of, oh crap, what was it now? I forget. I think it was Fuggle and
Hallertown, Middlefru, and Liberty.
Nailed it.
Exactly, yeah, like Logan cluster. Said.
I was so far off.
Our phone's great, guys.
I read this like an entire 16 hours ago, so
yeah.
Don't worry about it.
A truly modern triploid hop, Waiiti brings sort of a fresh splash of lime and stone fruit. We've actually used Waiiti quite a bit. We use Waiiti a lot in our IPLs.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal overall hop because it doesn't overwhelm. It's not super heavy and pungent like you get from a Mosaic or a Simcoe or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it has all those bright flavors that you want, and I think it'd be good in a refreshing style beer like the Australian Sparkling Ale.
Yep. And then as for hop additions for this style, you're actually going to probably hold back a little bit. So it says that the hops play a supporting role. So you shouldn't dominate it quite like pale ale or IPL. So I would recommend a hop dosage, I guess, for a 5-gallon batch, somewhere around that 2-ish, maybe 3-ish ounces. I probably wouldn't go more than that. IBUs are 20 to 30-ish. I can probably pull that up and verify real quick for you, though.
I mean, I have it right here.
Yeah, bam.
20
to 35 IBUs. But this beer should also finish very dry with final gravities around 1.004 to 1.006, which is bone dry for a beer.
Hashtag foreshadowing for a later topic.
Foreshadowing. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. So that bitterness is actually going to be pretty prominent in the beer because it doesn't have a lot of sweetness. Speaking of sweetness, part of the style guidelines do say that any kind of crystal or caramel malt is inappropriate, which is also why I am falling in love with this style.
Does that sound like Logan's closer to the mic?
No, oh, sorry. Let me move my whole chair. which is also why I'm falling in love with this style because as... If you've watched our channel for any length of time, you'll know that Peter and I do not like caramel malts. We feel like they're way, way overused and tend to dominate beers when they almost always should not be there.
They don't want to. So speaking of not caramel malts.
Speaking of not caramel malts, our malt of the week we chose is actually honey malt.
Honey malt's a unique one because it can be very sweet if you use it incorrectly. However, it's also a pseudo-acidulated malt. It's coated in lactic acid. What that does is it actually takes a relatively sweet flavor and brings it into a relatively honey-like world where it doesn't become overbearing or overpowering. So honey malt you can actually use up to maybe a half pound before it starts to get on that actually sweet side. Up to a pound, you'll definitely notice it as sweet, but it still won't be cloying like using a pound of C60 or something like that. So honey malt's a really fun one to kind of get... not only for balancing out water chemistry, if you're using a half pound of it, I think that'd be really good for any light ales that you're doing if you have a relatively neutral water profile, but also just developing phenomenally complex flavor with maintaining the posterity of having a bright flavored beer.
Yeah, so honey malt, like Peter said, I would recommend using this at about a half pound of the total grist bill, which otherwise the grist is probably going to consist of, I would probably, off the top of my head, let's just throw together a recipe for you, actually. So a beer like this, it doesn't have a super high starting gravity. So I would probably use our good old Heidelberg malt. It suggests any kind of Australian based two row, but I realize where you're at, you're probably not always going to be able to get that. But some kind of a highly modified, malt, but, also a malt that's just going to dry out for you nicely. About 9 pounds, I think is all I would shoot for a base malt. Assuming that you're going to get a pretty high efficiency. Starting gravities for this are only 1038 to 1050, so pretty low starting gravities as well. And then about a half pound of that honey malt. And really, I think that is all you're going to need. So you want to keep this fairly simple because the other key to making sure that beer does dry out nicely is a really, really low mashing temperature.
Yeah.
You're going to want to mash right around 145 degrees. I honestly... Maybe even 140 isn't going to kill anything.
If you have a way to ramp it up, that works really, really well. Start at 140 and slowly rise up into your mash out temperature.
Yeah, so definitely try to hit the very, very low end of your mash temps. It might sound crazy for you compared to what you usually do, but that is going to be essential in making sure you get that single-digit final gravity and keeping that beer nice and dry. So pretty simple malt bill. And then, for hops, I would do probably for Waiiti. I know it's a pretty low alpha hop, so I'd probably do an ounce and a half.
Half pound, yes, for a 5.25 gallon batch.
I mean, you can always throw more.
Or a 20 liter batch.
So yeah, I would probably do about an ounce and a half of Waiiti at boil, and boil that for 60 minutes.
45 grams.
45 grams, yeah, something like that. And then about another ounce and a half, as I wouldn't go quite like flame out. This I would actually still probably add at about a 5 or 10 minute addition, and fairly straightforward hops. And then again, the co-pitch of yeast, ferment that right around 70 degrees if you can. And yeah, should work really well. If you do want it clear, you'll probably want to add some finings, especially if you are co-pitching that Czech lager, because it will not like to drop like that 1335 will. So yeah, that is more or less the beer of the week. I'm trying to remember if I missed anything. Oh, there is one more thing I missed. And that is actually the water chemistry. Very important part of this. And that is because the water chemistry for this should be very hard as well. So pretty, from what I could find, almost a Burton on Trent profile. So
yeah, that is hard.
So high, lots of bicarbonates, and then a pretty high sulfate to chloride ratio is what you're going to be shooting for. Oh, did it actually tell you like what waters are in there? Oh no, Peter doesn't have actual numbers. So sorry, don't have actual numbers. But try to shoot for. I would say about a 4-to-1 would be reasonable of your sulfate to chloride ratio.
If interested in actual numbers, feel free to message us later and on Facebook, and we can shoot those over to you. And actually do some calculations rather than speculations.
Yeah, and then bicarbonates, somewhere in that, probably close to, I would say like 200 parts per million. So nice, nice, sharp, minerally profile for you. All right, well, let's go on to our discussion topics now. I think that pretty much covers our beer of the week, a fun style. I will, like I said before, I will try to throw together a recipe at the end of this live stream and post it down in the links once this gets published on YouTube. Well, shall you take us away, Peter?
Take me away. The first discussion topic is actually how to dry out beer. Speaking of beers that are supposed to ferment super, super, super dry. One quick callback, though, I did just look at the very end of the water profile. It says variable water profile, so you can kind of go run the gamut, but usually it's going to be lower carbonate, actually, and moderate sulfate. So the sulfate's definitely higher than the chlorides. So that kind of sounds a little bit Czech Pilsner-y, actually, for the water profile. But yeah, moving on. How to dry out beer. So drying out beer is something that is especially important for these coming summer days. If you're doing something that you want to be a nice sessionable beer, good lawnmower beer, like the Australian Sparkling Ale, drying out beer is a process/practice that's probably going to bode you well. That way you're not being like, hey, I want to make a Maibock/Amber for the summer, and it's going to finish at 1016 or 4 Plato.
Okay.
That's
freezing
the
Play-Doh now.
I don't know.
Anyway,
3.8 bricks.
Yes, and so the easiest way to dry out beer is actually just by choosing the right kinds of malts, choosing highly modified malts, and choosing lower mash temperatures, like we already mentioned in brewing that sparkling ale. By choosing a highly fermentable malt, you know, keeping adjuncts out, you're basically doing the opposite of what. A lot of times you'll be seeing like with hazies. So, you know, go easy on any adjunct malts like flaked wheat or flaked oat. Definitely don't put any type of caramel malts in there if you're looking to dry beers out. And then also, yeah, shoot for a mash temp that's definitely sub-150s.
Yeah, so don't use 100% carapils like we're going to do. And well, actually, you can, but if you got to know the right technique. So yeah, starting with a highly fermentable, that means low protein content. That's what we mean by highly modified base malt. It's going to be the number one key to having a generally light beer. That mashing low, what that's going to do is break down your longer chain starches that may or may not be fermentable, depending on your yeast strain. So like Logan was saying, a 145 mash temp, if you let it sit there for 90 minutes, you're going to have a pretty fermentable wort. That's not a bad way to go. The other way to start drying out beer is actually start with less overall malt and then plan on adding highly fermentable sugars sometime during fermentation.
Yeah, so one of the common practices we actually use to purposely dry beer out is adding sugars. So adding things So Belgian beers, I think, are a great example of this, in that Belgian beers are generally high in alcohol and yet still have a light-ish body to them despite having huge, huge amounts of, like, big, sweet, caramely malts to them. And that's because they actually add sugar to the beer as well. And that sugar is going to be close to 100% fermentable, which ends up drying the beer out.
The most classic example of a highly fermentable sugar is going to be dextrose, which is actually just glucose, single pyruvate or whatever that thing's called, that basically yeast can eat with no energy to spare, or no energy that they have to use. But things like honey, maple syrup, brown sugar, cane sugar, things like that will also work. Those are just two sugar molecules basically plopped together, so they're slightly harder for yeast to eat. But those will still be 100% fermentable.
Yeah, even double IPAs, West Coast style IPAs, the big guys, like big guys, especially like Elysian, and I'm trying to think of who else makes
the big
things.
Guys like Elysian. I don't know, Ballast Point,
Stone,
New Belgium.
Stone's was the one I was thinking of.
Samuel Adams.
So all those West Coast IPAs that are 8% but still have a nice dry body. I almost guarantee you they're not telling you, but they're just adding regular old dextrose or corn sugar to the beer in order to up that ABV by 2 or 3% while maintaining that dry body, because otherwise it's really, really hard to achieve a 9% beer that's bone dry.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
with all malt.
If you want to do a double IPA that doesn't taste like something that you need to be like, you know. Yeah, exactly. You really have to be adding dextrose. That's the big key. And a rule of thumb with any of these fermentable sugars is the more of your alcohol that you're getting from these fermentable sugars, the more you actually need to stagger your addition. So you can add some, like maybe up to 1-1.5% of your alcohol from highly fermentable sugars right into the kettle to pitch with your regular yeast and everything like that. But if you're trying to gain more than 2 or 3% alcohol from these highly fermentable sugars, it actually does you a lot of favor in terms of your yeast health and the off flavors, the really high fusely alcohols that the yeast can give, if you stagger that addition and add some of that sugar or all of that sugar at about 2/3 sugar depletion.
Yep. So one of the newer methods of also drying a beer out is actually adding either an alpha or a beta amylase in various stages. We probably saw this kind of come a couple years back with the introduction of the Brut IPA, which you are adding a beta amylase straight to your fermentation, which dropped the gravity of the beer down to zero or even sub-zero in some cases.
Sub-zero.
But that's not the only way to add this. You can actually add this directly to your mash as well in order to just get more 100% conversion.
Now you just got to say more drier.
More drier, yeah.
So you got more newer, and then you got to say making a more drier mash.
A more drier, better mash.
We actually do add zymes to our mash sometimes. So there's occasions, for example, if we're not really paying attention, we overshoot our mash temperature because we have a hot liquor tank that basically goes up to whatever we want it to go up to. So if that's really hot and we end up mashing in because we don't think too much about it and our mash comes in at 155 Fahrenheit, sorry, I don't know the Celsius conversion, or higher, that's actually at a temperature that will degrade beta amylase. And so what we'll do is we'll just wait until our mash drops back down a little bit and then we'll add enzyme into the mash before continuing our whole process. That just ensures that we get a nice, clean, fermentable mash. And it's actually a really nice tool that we have, so we don't, you know, if we do mess up, we can kind of fix it. Whereas if you're doing it on the homebrew scale and you don't have enzymes, once that beta amylase is denatured, you're going to end up with a chewy beer.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and the beauty of adding it in the mash is that you will denature that enzyme in the boil, unlike adding it directly to your fermentation. So you can end up with sort of a pseudo brut, or honestly, even like the Australian sparkling ale. If for some reason you have a hard time getting down below 10-10 gravity, you know, you could probably add a little bit to it, last 15 minutes or so in your mash, just to get that extra conversion and get those points to drop down another 3 or 4 points for you before you ramp your temps up and kill that.
So yeah. Another thing, another time that we'll add enzyme during fermentation, so that's going to be the amyloglucosidase, AMG, or also known as glucoamylase, but is if we're doing a really big beer, like a barley wine, for example, because a lot of times when you're doing a really big beer, even if you're mashing in it like a standard 150, like you expect to for most beers, that's still going to end up, let's say you're aiming for an 11% beer, your final gravity will normally probably fit into that 1030 range, which is still pretty chewy. So if you want to get that below 1020, you're still going to have to add some enzymes during fermentation, usually in my experience with some nutrient and maybe even a sugar addition. Making big beers a little bit drier is kind of important for things like that too.
Yep. So lastly, let's talk about what kind of yeast you're pitching, or even bacteria in some cases, to that will actually make their own enzymes that can convert and dry a beer out for you.
That's right. And I think this is a good topic for going into any sort of summer beer that's really nice and bright and palatable, because I think Saisons specifically are fantastic summer, spring, like hot weather beers. They've got a lot of lemony, bright pop, a lot of phenols that really dance on your palate. Yeah. And those are a good example. So French Saison is the one I'm thinking of. A good example of a diastatic is strain.
Yeah. So when you're looking at yeast catalogs, I guess, most companies now will actually list at the very bottom if a yeast is a quote-unquote diastaticus variant. And what that means is that that yeast can actually produce these enzymes and will actually dry a beer out quite a bit more than what a traditional non-diastaticus variant yeast would.
What that means is that if you want to have a lot of fun with your friends, do a three-week fermentation, make sure there's a diastaticus variant in there, give them a bunch of bottles of that beer, and tell them to sit on it for about 8 months.
Eight?
I don't know. 9 months?
Nine. Yeah.
7 months?
Better.
7 months in hot weather.
7 months. Yeah. Throw it in the back of your car and let her rip. So usually Saison strains. I think there's a couple other Belgian strains that are diastaticus variants, but as well as Brettanomyces. Most Brettanomyces strains, from what I know of, are also diastaticus variants. So they'll also continue to dry a beer out slowly but surely.
Yeah, and so the whole bottling and sending to your friends joke means that if you do bottle those beers early on and let them age for a while, they will be highly carbonated. They will be geysers by the time you open them several months down the road. And you do run the risk, if they're not like high-pressure bottles, of getting bottle bombs.
Yeah. So with all this said, this is typically something, especially if you're kegging your homebrew, if you get Brett in there, it's not something to get super paranoid or super worried about, because it does. It takes months and months on end for this really, really slow fermentation to happen. So it's something that's going to happen. Yes, if you're aging a Brett sour for a year and a half or 2 years, it's something to take into consideration. Maybe not even add priming sugar when you go to bottle it at that point. But if it's a beer that you're bottling and drinking or kegging up, and drinking normally, you know, within a couple 3 month period, it's kept in cold storage, it shouldn't ever be an issue for you.
Yeah. So that's about it for strategies for drying out beer. To run over them really quick, you've got highly modified malts. That means low protein. We've got mashing at a low temperature. We've got adding highly fermentable sugars to the mash. We've got adding enzyme, and we've got using a diastaticus variant yeast. Those are the strategies we have for brewing crisp, bright, dry, fun beers.
All right. So our next topic is something that Peter got distracted with yesterday and spent about 4 hours on the computer. And
I did not.
That is going through homebrew Reddit pages and sort of our breakdown and our first interpretation of whether or not this can be a good thing or a bad thing, and whether or not it's a feasible resource to try to learn stuff from.
Yeah, so before we go too much into this, let me ask you guys, what do you think? Do you guys all use Reddit? I personally have actually never used Reddit before. The one time that I made a Reddit account previous to this was actually because Pokemon Go used to have like an atlas of all the stops that was on Reddit, and so I used to use Reddit for that, and that's about the only time that I've ever used Reddit. But it did seem like a really interesting forum, like a lot of people discussing homebrew topics, and we like any chance we have to connect with the homebrew community. So I figured it might be worth a shot. But do you guys use it? Is that a thing? Let us know. Oh, and also, before we go too much further, I see we've got 131 people watching us. If all of you can give us a thumbs up on this video, that would be super duper duper cool. Do it right now.
Damn. Okay, so Reddit generally is a place for people to gather, for people to share information, for people to, learn new ideas from one another. But at the same time, we all know that the interwebs have this weird sort of dark backside to them, where everyone just kind of likes to hate on each other and say that one idea is terrible, even though they probably have never had any experience with that idea, so to speak.
And as much as Logan loves dark backsides, that's not necessarily a positive thing. Because, first of all, it can be a spread of misinformation. And second of all, it can be, what's it called, an echo chamber where people support the idea that, or the notion that one idea is starkly or staunchly better than another idea, which I've seen a lot in the homebrew world. There's a lot of people that go against, for example, our myths videos and say, no, I read this in this book several years ago. This is absolutely the 100% way to brew. And if you brew outside of this way, then you're going to make bad beer, which we don't believe in because we believe in adventure and fun.
Yeah. We believe in trying things and then seeing how they work out and going, wow, look at that. We did something that people said not to do and it actually turned out even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a general, been an issue with brewing blogs in general, I guess you can say, for years now. And I know when I was a fledgling brewer, I looked at a lot of stuff and I saw things posted everywhere about one person would say, yes, I did this, turned out great. The next person would say, nope, that's a terrible way to go. You never want to do it that way. So really it's tough to sort of find your way through all of the bad and find the good. And really, I think that's probably why one of the reasons why we actually started this YouTube channel in the first place was just to say, hey, there's more than one way to brew a beer.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be this Nazi-like
regime
of yes, do this, then do that. If not, everything will be ruined.
Yeah, the benefit, and I think something that we have done and like to do, and one of the biggest reasons that we started the YouTube channel in the first place is because us ourselves, we've brewed thousands of batches of beer unabashedly, meaning we have, you know, we've taken to exploring these myths and whether or not they've worked. But we've also personally talked with people, you know, that have brewed tens of thousands of beers that we've helped. And, you know, we've talked to everybody from the very beginning brewer to somebody who's brewed 5 or 10 batches to somebody who's brewed 100 batches to an actual professional brewer in the industry. So we've talked about these topics with people on all different aspects of the brewing spectrum, which I think gives us a unique interpretation of how we can relay this information to you guys. Because, you know, we want to have the most general but most specific and focused idea of, you know, how we can portray information as possible.
Yeah. So, and I guess what it really comes down to for Reddit, to sum all this up, is that, yes, there is some great information out there. But take everything you read with a grain of salt, because so Peter and I might be able to look at something and go, oh, yeah, that person's probably full of it. But as a fledgling homebrewer, you might not be able to tell the difference. So, you know, read more than one discussion about the same topic and then really kind of use your own understanding to try to figure out what might be best. And then again, like we said over and over again, never be afraid to experiment.
Yeah. So just brew thousands of batches of beers like us and be like, oh, yep, they were right. That didn't work. Or yeah, it did work.
Yeah. I mean, using common judgment too. I mean, just that's the biggest thing. If something, even if you're not experienced, if you read something and you look at it and you go, that just sounds weird, odds are it probably is. But if you look at something that somebody might be critical about, and you go, I don't really see any reason why that wouldn't work. The person that's being critical probably does not have, you know, any, you know, good data, any good information to really back up why they're being critical, other than, well, I heard this from somebody that heard it from somebody that heard it from somebody that brewed beer 80 years ago.
Yeah, they read it in a book back when, you know, malt was still hand malted.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And we only had 5 hop varieties to work with.
Yeah. Overall, though, we did make a Reddit account, and so we have a Reddit page now. My thought is if we end up getting hooked into that community, we've got a lot of mixed people saying, you know, it's great or it's, you know, pseudoscience on here, which is kind of what we expected. It's going to be a little bit, you know, one way or the other. The bottom line is we do like the fact that it's an open forum for people to communicate. And so we made a Reddit account. And if you want to find our Reddit account and give suggestions on what we can be doing for next week's live stream, let us know on Reddit.
Somebody's saying Reddit equals Nazi brewers. Who knew? Yeah.
We're not saying it's Nazi brewers. We're just saying that some Nazis might be on Reddit.
Oh, gosh. And demonetized. All right. So at this point,
I said not cheese. I said not cheese. Don't demonetize us.
So let's go ahead and open things up to a general discussion now. I know I already saw a question earlier about somebody that had, I believe, a homebrew shop, but they said they were having issues. Oh, yeah, so a homebrew shop, but is not clean, and they charge way too much, which is really unfortunate to hear because, yes, while we, as a homebrew shop ourselves, always want to say, yeah, go support local, don't send business to the big guys. For a lot of people, we realize that's just not practical or even possible sometimes if you don't have a local homebrew shop. Generally, I think somebody mentioned it, Adventures in Homebrewing is a great online source. They're pretty good guys there. Also, morebeer.com. We do try to say avoid Northern Brewer.
It's because they're owned by AB InBev.
Because, yeah, it's because they did get bought out a few years back now, I think, by Anheuser-Busch. So they're not really about the homebrew market anymore so much as just making money. So that would be my advice if you don't have a good local homebrew shop. Otherwise, you know, maybe try to give them some, like, feedback and be like, hey, guys, like, I want to support you, but you know, clean up your business or something. I don't know. You know, there is one thing too. It wouldn't actually hurt to ask. If you say their prices are too high, I know we try to be as competitive as possible. We're actually constantly checking online prices ourselves here. As a general rule of thumb, if we can't get something for a reasonable wholesale price, we usually just won't carry it. But with that said, we do price match anything online as well.
Yeah, so never hurts to ask if they're going to price match, especially for like really high end stuff. Like a lot of times, we wish people would ask us. You know, they're about to go buy a $500 super fancy conical or something like that.
Yep.
You know, ask us if we can price match, and a lot of times we just say, by the way, our price is already the same, so
yeah,
just buy it from us. You know, and even if it's not a huge markup for us, that's still, you know, that still could be $50 in our pockets that helps us, you know, be able to get more inventory and carry a larger selection for the people that come in and shop with us.
Yeah, and get more videos out for you.
Yeah. So, in terms of being elitist, as I think it was worded, we do know a lot of people in the industry that have homebrew supply stores that kind of end up getting that elitist attitude, which is also unfortunate. I think it's a product of just talking to a lot of people over a long time and thinking that as a homebrew supply store, you need to be viewed as the expert. I think the best thing a homebrew supply person, someone in our position, could do isn't necessarily caring about being viewed as the expert, but being, you know, more concerned with being viewed as someone who's a really good person to have in the discussion. That way it's more of an open forum. It's more of a, hey, let's talk about this. Let's share ideas kind of thing, which means we get to learn more even faster. And then also we're not, you know, so, oh, I know more than you. And it turns people off, which, you know, I'm not going to say who, but other people have that attitude.
Bam. Somebody is also asking where we learned all of our water chemistry from. And that is from drinking a lot of beer.
Yeah, we drink a lot of beer, and that's just all we do. And so if you drink enough beer, you osmotically gain the knowledge of how that beer was made. That is science.
So yes, ultimately, I think Peter and I have read lots of little tiny sources, but a lot of it, too, has to do with brewing and actually just messing with water chemistry and beer. Peter has had a pretty good understanding of background of chemistry to begin with. That's what he actually went to school for. But also a great resource I would recommend if you just kind of want to dive right into it is actually the book. It's a series of books. It's called Water. Do you remember?
Yeah, that's John Palmer's book.
Is that John Palmer? Yeah, by John Palmer. It's literally just a book called Water.
I think it's Palmer and somebody else, like Palmer and Zanishev or something like that.
Maybe Bucard, I don't know.
But anyways, Water, it's part of the AHA series, so they have a book called Water, Malt, Yeast, Hops, things like that. Fantastic book, and it does give a really good breakdown of water chemistry. That said, it can be really heavy to kind of try to digest. If you don't have a chemistry background or aren't super interested in talking about, molarity and random things like that. But I would recommend maybe just starting with one component to your water chemistry and doing a little bit of experimentation. The easiest to start with is probably sulfates to chlorides. Just take your standard water, figure out what happens when you add some gypsum versus what happens if you add some calcium chloride. Both have calcium as the anion. The cation is either chloride or sulfate. And so you can kind of get a good idea of what just adding one of those things is going to do to your final beer.
Yeah. And those will make the biggest difference. I know that's basically how I got into it, is just playing a little bit with that. And noticed a night and day difference between especially my hop forward beers.
Yeah. So. Someone's asking if you can cultivate yeast from bottled/canned beer with DME with DME. So basically doing a starter and building up bottled slash canned beer. Yes, you can. You need to make sure that it's non-filtered or pasteurized beer. And then also take a good hard look at the age of that beer too. It works a lot better for sours because those yeasts are a little bit more hardy and robust, especially the souring bacteria. If it is, you know, a standard American ale and it might be, you know, not pasteurized slash unfiltered beer, that yeast could go through some changes slash just with the stress. It can go through some mutations. So if you build up that yeast, by the time that you get it to a full pitchable level for your 5-gallon batch, that yeast has gone through so many multiplications, it could have actually mutated. And it might mutate for the better. That's entirely possible, but it also might end up tasting a little funky.
Yeah. Somebody's asking about using amylase on a Bud Light clone with a bunch of corn and rice. And I suppose you could, but Bud Light is actually kind of a sweeter beer. Its gravity isn't like terribly, terribly low because it has a really low gravity to start with. So I want to say yes, but if you're actually trying to clone a Bud Light, that's probably not the best way to go.
You're talking about the using amylase on a...
Yeah, on a rice/corn adjunct beer, unless you're going 100% rice and corn, in which...
In which case you need it. No, it's going to be something like a Heidelberg or a Six Row with a high amount of corn/rice adjunct. Honestly, if you mash low, you can probably get that, you know, in the Bud Light range, you could probably get it down to, you know, 10.02 or 10.04 without any amylase at all, actually.
Yeah, that's the thing is you're talking about a beer that has a OG of like 10.28 to it. So really, really low starting gravity. I mean, you're talking like for a 5-gallon batch, we're talking 6 pounds of grains here. So not much to work with from the get-go, so I don't really think it's necessary. Biggest thing is that they use like virtually zero hops. For a 5-gallon batch, you're going to use like a tenth of an ounce of hops in it. It's like something in the range of like 5 IBUs, I think. It's pretty ridiculous. So
someone has 12 pounds of Golden Light DME and they want to make a sessionable summer ale with either Summit, Goldings, Pato, Eroica, Sriracha Ace, or German Hallertau Blanc. I'm guessing you're wanting to make for that. If you're doing a sessionable beer, it's going to be a 10 to 15-gallon batch with 12 pounds of DME. And a lot of those hops would be great. Eroica and Hallertau Blanc would be nice and bright, a little bit of white wine notes. Pato will be a little bit more pungent and have some earthy grassiness reminiscent of like a Saaz, but just a little bit more extra. So anything in that range, I would probably steer clear of the Sriracha Ace unless you want a little bit more herbal notes. The Goldings I'd probably steer clear of.
And the Summit as well.
Yeah. That's
if you want like a really like kind of like grassy one, I guess you could do Sriracha and Summit.
Yeah.
And Pato. The Eroica I'm actually not super familiar with, so I don't think we've brewed with that yet, have we?
No, I don't think
we
have.
I bought it at one point, never used it. Definitely that's a lot of DME for a 5-gallon batch, so throw a few of those out there. Load them up late is the biggest thing. No matter, you know, despite whatever hops you're using, if you load them late addition, you'll end up with a less bitter beer. So that's really the biggest thing for if you're trying to make a nice sessionable one.
Yeah. Someone says I talk too fast. Yes, I do. I apologize for that. It's a bad habit I've had since I was young, but I'm working on it. The more I get on camera, I try to slow myself down. Some of my recent videos have been a lot better. Sulfates to chlorides also can be adjusted as you're drinking the beer. Oh yeah, they sure can. I knew a lot of people a lot of people a while ago actually used to add salt to the beer just to kind of mellow it out, like make it less bitter. And that absolutely works. Like just a tiny dash of salt. When I was first getting into the beer industry, I met a lot of old people that did that.
Oh, yes. Adding a little salt to the beer. Yeah, I've done that before, actually. I've salted beer. What else did we add to beer, actually? I added, I think it was citric.
Kool-Aid? Yeah. Oh, maybe not. Citric acid?
Yeah, citric acid to a beer and actually made like a pseudo sour right in the glass. That was when we were making like the mojito beer. Because we got the mojito flavoring and we took a pilsner and or a cerveza, something like that. Add a little citric acid, added the mojito thing, and it was like really oddly mojito-y beer. And actually like kind of worked.
I remember that.
Back when we were like, this is weird.
The Amaretti sample pack. Yeah, citric acid is a highly flavorful acid. It's the same acid that makes a lot of the flavor in citrus fruits, and so it's a fun one to use. Someone wants a suggestion for fermentis lager yeast for a clean pilsner. If you've got temperature control, S23 is the prodigal. If you don't have temperature control, 3470 is the one to go with for sure. And so if you're going to be fermenting at a, you know, like let's say 60 to 65, 3470. If you can ferment at 52 and then also do a ramping schedule where you get up to a VDK rest, then the S23.
Funny somebody's asking, because we did an entire video on fermentis yeast. Hashtag shameless plug. we did, if you want to learn more about those, we did a video. We're actually planning on trying to do one for all the Y yeast, which will be a little more daunting because
there's a lot more Y yeast.
There's a lot more Y yeast, but I think we can get through it.
Are you guys all down for sitting through a 35-minute video on Y yeast? Raise your hand. Can you talk about how you combine multiple strains of yeast? Also, timing on when you add them to the batch. That is very dependent on the yeast.
Yeah.
That's a tough topic to get into because you kind of have to know, first of all, which strains are more competitive than other strains.
And that's the biggest part for sure. Yeah. Is the competitiveness of the yeast strain and how much character you want from the yeast strain.
Yeah.
So we actually co-pitch quite a bit here. Usually that's more a means of
getting rid of old yeast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to put it blatantly, yeah, it's getting rid of old yeast. You know, we have a lot of liquid yeast here, and of course it has a finite-ish shelf life to it. So usually once it starts getting anywhere close, usually actually once it gets like much more than honestly 6 weeks, 2 months old, we'll start pulling it and we'll use it ourselves. And a lot of times we'll actually combine several packets into a single starter that we'll either put into like a one barrel batch or sometimes even a bigger batch. But it's a great thing because it ends up, you know, as long as we know that there can be strains that work well together, you end up getting this really, really nice blended flavor profile as a result. So,
O2 transfer video. If you don't put CO2 in the top of your fermenter, there's not a ton of O2 is the question. So that is absolutely fine for the vast majority of beers. The biggest reason to have pressure and CO2 on the top of your tank is when you're doing hazy IPAs, because the massive dry hop in hazy IPAs makes them super, super susceptible to oxidation. Think of it like any sort of fruit that you cut, like an apple that you cut open, and how it starts to brown really quickly. It's the same thing when you have that much hop material in your beer. It starts to get that, that purpley kind of flavor. If you can't do a proper low-dose transfer, you're running a really dramatic risk, especially if you don't ascorbic acid your beer with any sort of hazies. So, like I said, 99% of the beers, you're definitely fine. You're probably not picking up enough oxygen to do anything to the beer just with a regular gravity transfer. But with hazies, milkshakes, things like that specifically, low-dose transfer is almost necessary.
And I've even read some articles that it has to do with the high the high protein content in there too. And there's either, I don't remember if it was proteins or oils that'll actually bind with the hop phenols in there as well. So I probably shouldn't talk much more because that was a while ago and I forget. But yeah, that has something to do with the fact that those beers are also extremely, extremely susceptible to oxidization.
Thoughts on adding ice directly to the fermenter to cool down your batch of beer? It works. The biggest thing that you risk with adding ice, well, first of all, it's got to be like store-bought UV pasteurized, for sure, sanitary ice. And make sure you're not getting it from like a dirty store that like that cooler's never been cleaned out in their life. But the other thing is that you're probably going to get a hazy beer. The breakout when you add ice to the fermenter to cool down your wort, for whatever reason, always leaves some haze in there compared to just cooling it down with a chiller.
It is effective, though.
It is effective. It cools it down. And we've made some great tasting beers by doing it.
I was going to say, yeah, we've had beers that have actually
with our speed beer.
Really good. Yeah, and usually the ice, in order to make it clear, a lot of times they'll run it through a RO filter too, so you actually end up softening up your water profile by adding it, which if you're doing extract is usually not the worst case scenario.
Dan says he can close transfer, but getting CO2 into the fermenter is an animal rights organization.
Is a what?
PETA.
Oh yes, people eating tasty. Oh wait.
Yeah.
yeah. No. Honestly, so I've jerry-rigged a lot of pseudo closed transfers where just so that I'm not sucking oxygen in the fermenter, I'm taking my CO2 and I'm essentially squirting it into a gap at a really, really low pressure, just so that I'm trying to maintain some kind of a blanket as that level of beer is being drawn down. While, yeah, that's not perfect, it's better than nothing. It's better than just sucking in an atmosphere and other possible contaminants. So even if you can rig up a janky system, then that's better than nothing for those hazies. Do you want to answer the ascorbic question? I feel like we answer this every week.
Ascorbic acid. We use ascorbic acid because it's a very powerful antioxidant. If you have ever bought pre-sliced apples in the store, that's coated with ascorbic acid, which is why those apples do not turn brown compared to if you just open up an apple. So ascorbic acid is a phenomenal buffer against oxidation. The technically right answer is you can just add it to the fermenter, but we always add it to our mash. It's not going to break down. It'll still work just as effectively if you add it to the mash.
Or your tea if you want to avoid scurvy.
That's right.
Craig is asking a great question about software. And yeah, we sure do use software to design our beers. We use Brewer's Friend. Wow.
We use Brewer's Friend. We probably wouldn't use software nearly as much if we didn't have to actually record every single beer that we make, because we have to give it to the federal government and say, here, take our souls.
Because of legals and stuff. But Brewer's Friend from the get-go has actually been by far the most user-friendly and nowadays pretty well encompassing software. I've used both Brewer's Friend and Beersmith. Used Beersmith a little bit before Brewer's Friend came out. And the beauty I like to say about Brewer's Friend is the ability to actually track a beer after the brew day. That's one thing Beersmith has kind of been lacking from the get-go, is you can basically build up a recipe on it, but after you build up your recipe, there's not a good way to keep any kind of notes or anything afterwards and actually, you know, let yourself know like how the beer turned out, how long it took to ferment, how the fermentation went. And Brewer's Friend is really, really good about actually keeping a log, keeping that all up in the cloud. So if your computer crashes, you're still never going to lose it. And being able to actually go back and say, oh, wow, look at that beer that I brewed on this date. I kegged it up on that date. These are my tasting notes on it. It blew in like a week, so it must have been pretty good.
I was eating pancakes that morning. You can take so many notes.
Yeah.
So many notes on Brewer's Friend. It's great. How about we give you
solid bowel movement.
Yeah. That does make a difference in brew day. Matt Cloud, the idea of giving us recipes and we brew them, that sounds like a really fun idea, actually. I'm not sure. There's a lot of things that have to go with the logistics of when we have small batch fermenters to be able to play around with, especially now with the Willet beers. So I'm not sure how quickly we'd be able to turn that into an action, but it sounds like a really fun idea. I do like that. Someone also asking if we've used the tilt hydrometers. We have not. However, I just saw another YouTuber playing around with those, and they look super interesting. However, a lot of the small batch fermenters,
aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty expensive. They're like a Wi-Fi. What's your gravity?
One of those fancy things.
But yeah, a lot of the fermenters that we use actually don't use airlocks in the first. Tilt hydrometers, not airlocks. I was thinking of a different thing. I don't know what the tilt hydrometer is.
You don't know what the tilt hydrometer is?
No, I thought for some reason I was thinking of that airlock that's like Wi-Fi enabled and tells you gravity.
Yeah, isn't that what they are?
Is that what?
I'm pretty sure that's what they are.
Oh, I thought it was something different. if that's the right hydro or airlock thing, then we don't use airlocks in a lot of our fermenters. So
that is true. Usually we actually will close them off and spund them, at least for the bigger beers.
Would you pressure ferment a lager with 3470 at 70 degrees to make up for the fact that it's not kept in the ideal temperature range? I mean, you could. It's going to tear through beer pretty fast. 3470, even at 70 degrees, will have like a nice Bavarian fruitiness, but it's not going to be not a light beer. It's not going to get super estery fruity like a British ale strain, so it'd still be fine even if you didn't pressure ferment. We haven't done a ton of side-by-sides with the same yeast pressure fermenting versus not pressure fermenting.
Yeah.
The majority of the time that we do any sort of pressure fermentation, it's really just to spund and capture our CO2 so we don't waste big bottles of CO2.
Yeah.
But yeah.
From what I've heard, it will. So pressure fermentation will slow down the growth of your yeast, which does cause it to produce less flavor components, ending in an overall cleaner beer. However, an article a year or so ago from Brewlosophy did find that there was a significant difference between a true cold fermented beer and a pressure fermented beer. With that said, though, that is not with the 3470 yeast. The 3470 yeast tends to ferment very clean regardless of the temperature. So I would say if you want to try to capture some CO2, go ahead and pressure ferment. If not, just let it ride at 70, and it'll be just as clean as it would be at 50.
So. Yeah, and it is very how pressure fermenting works is very yeast dependent. So just keep that in mind. You have to, if you're going to do tests, you have to do tests for each yeast that you use consistently, yep. And you got to do side by sides with each yeast because it's going to be wildly different. Someone says, I sometimes get a real bad flavor and taste after I put in the dry hops 2 to 3 days later. I dry hop when fermentation is almost done. It tastes really yeasty and strongly bitter. Two things that can make that dry hop taste bitter is one, old hops, especially if you're using pellet hops. We almost always recommend cryos just because they don't have as much vegetal matter that can go bad / oxidize, which can give you a bitter taste. And then also just finding a way to do it in as short of amount of time. So dry hopping for less than 2 or 3 days, less than 5 days. And then try to find a way to maybe maximize that surface area. So if you've got a closed system in line where you can go from, let's say, your fermenter to your keg and get a little hop filter that's all CO2 purged and do that in line, that'd theoretically be the best way to do it. Outside of that, the easiest way to ensure that you're getting a pseudo closed system is dry hop during high krausen.
So our next question somebody has about O5, they say it's over attenuating to 90%, and how to fix it. I would say make a less fermentable wort. 90% is actually pretty close to what we get if we use the Chico strain here, and that's because we typically will do simple grist bills with low mash temperatures. And if you're doing that, like we mentioned with our drying beer out, we'll have a mid 1050 beer go down to like 08. Which should be close to that 90%. And so that's just something that you actually expect. One thing to note, I would just say in general, at least with the methods that we use at Genus, is that when they list the attenuation of all the yeast strains in their package details, that's almost always going to be an underestimate based on our brewing methods. Obviously, yours are going to vary a little bit. Usually we will always almost up that attenuation to usually 80-85% at least, depending on the beer.
What spudding valve do we recommend? Blickman actually has the most user-friendly spudding valve that I've seen. So check out Blickman's website for the best spudding valve that you can get.
And if everybody knows people at Blickman, tell them that Genus wants their stuff and that they need to start wholesaling stuff.
Yeah, do it.
Oh, wait, no, not Blickman.
That's Spike.
I'm thinking of Spike.
Yeah, you can send both Blickman and Spike messages and then just tell them to send us stuff for free because that'd be awesome.
We already get some stuff from Blickman. They actually make some of the best products out there. Yeah.
Blickman makes the Anvil Foundry, and they've sent us an Anvil Foundry. They sent us the Riptide pumps. Yeah. Blickman's been really good to us, actually.
Yeah, Blickman.
Nothing against Spike. We just haven't gotten a lot of communication from Spike yet. But as we get bigger, maybe. We don't know.
Blickman may not be the cheapest option out there, but they definitely make quality stuff. Yeah.
And like I said, for the spunding valve, their spunding valve is super user friendly. So if you want a kind of a good intro to how to spund, Blickman's the way to go.
Converting 5 gallon batches to larger batches. So Brewer's Friend, that's one of the beauties of it is that you can do that in about 3 clicks, and it'll actually upscale your batch for you.
That said, there's always some playing around that you've got to do.
Yeah,
every batch style is different, and so when you're upscaling, a conversion to scale is just a starting point. Your evaporation rate's always going to be dramatically different depending on the shape, your mash efficiency. There's so many different things that go into what makes a beer consistent. A scaling technique is just a starting point, and you gotta keep that in mind when you're scaling. Someone wants to know how to get rid of unwanted wild yeast in your brewing equipment.
Kill it with fire.
Yeah, kill it with fire. Heat is the best way to kill everything.
Yeah.
So turn all your equipment that you use into stainless steel equipment.
Unfortunately, if you do actually have contamination in something like an auto siphon, those are like $12. Just go buy a new auto siphon at that point. Those are things that I know we replace every year or two. It's just something that's going to wear out over time. So. Otherwise, if you do have something that is heat sanitizable, get some boiling water. That'll kill everything. That's really my only advice for that. Make sure everything gets cleaned and dried before you put it away. That's probably the biggest source of contamination. Even though I know we've all had long brew days where it's, 9 o'clock at night and you got way too drunk and you just kind of want to leave everything for the morning, keep that in mind. Say, nah, I should probably not let this all get infected by morning, and I should clean up and put everything away. So
immediately do it. Best dry Belgian wit yeast. Mangrove Jacks makes the best one.
Yeah, this is good.
Yep. And that, I think, covers most of it.
Perfect.
All right. Well, somebody also asked what time we're opening. We're opening like nowish. So
in 5 minutes. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. I see there is still 133 of you out there. So please hit that thumbs up. Only half of you have done so.
It helps us out a bunch.
Helps us out a bunch. We will see you next week at approximately 8:45. Sorry we're a little bit late today, but generally people don't tune in for another 5 or 10 minutes after we get started. Otherwise, have a great week. Happy Memorial Day. Bye.